I'm Eric.
And I'm Matt.
And together we are Ranking 76, so we are interrupting your normally scheduled podcast just to talk about...
The Wild West, a cold, dangerous, merciless place, a place of lawlessness and violence. Join us on our adventure as we take you through the trials and sacrifices the settlers and Native Americans took to shape the...
Dear God, man, are you okay? That hurt my throat.
I'm okay.
Okay, well, while Matt's recovering, I'm just gonna take an opportunity to tell you that we review and rank the heroes and villains of the American West and then divide them up on our own individual teams, and then at the end, we're gonna face them off in each other to see who can build the best team in the West. And Matt, have you recovered?
Join us!
Okay, back to your regular show, everyone.
I'm Lucy.
And I'm Michelle.
Welcome to another episode of Tudoriferous, the biographical podcast that examines lives in the Tudor era. Right, got it right this time. We've only done 100-odd of these things.
And we got it wrong every time.
And today, part three of Charles VIII.
Yes.
And we left Charles last week in Naples.
Yeah, so frustrated with the Italians.
Yes.
Get it together. There were so many options for you to stop him at the top. And he got all the way down to Naples.
Yeah. He'd made a miraculous sweep down Italy and had taken Naples, much to everyone's surprise and annoyance. And as usual, yeah, the rest of them only got their act together when it was too late.
Yes.
And they created a league to stop him.
Yeah, we created a league. Oh, hi. You're here already.
Yes. Yeah. And they were split as to the best policy. Let him go back through Italy unhindered just to get him out of the country, or hem him in and annihilate him and his troops. Meanwhile, in Naples, the French troops have caused havoc. And by havoc, we know what we mean. And the Neapolitans just want to see the back of them, even if it means getting the hated Aragonese back.
Which is astounding.
Yes, yes. One after another of the Aragonese leaders have been tyrants, and now they're saying, please come back. We hate the French.
Well, don't bring them back. Pick somebody new.
Yeah, who are they going to
have? Form a republic. Yeah. Vote for somebody.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, they have got Florence as a... Well, yeah, right. Perhaps we just made our own argument.
No. We're not doing this. No. Have you seen what they're doing over there?
Yes, they just dither all the time. Okay, on the 5th of April, the Venetian ambassadors paid a visit to Charles in Naples and told them about the forming of the League. And Charles was very affronted.
Why? I'm a nice guy.
He told them that he'd rather have been told about it when they were setting it up, rather than waiting to tell him when every man and his dog knew about it. That seemed to be his main problem. So why didn't you tell me before?
I wanted to be a part of it.
Yes. So who were we against again? The ambassadors told him that it had only been done for the protection of the Italian states against the Turks. Which was not true.
Liar!
And Charles pointed out that he had an Italian state too, you know, and who was going to protect him from the Turks?
Oh, dear.
Charles realised it was time to retreat. I mean, Philippe de Comines had been telling him, leave, go now, for goodness sake. And he was saying, yeah, okay, whatever. I'm too busy being affable. Not just to make an orderly journey home, but a sort of let's get the hell out of here kind of retreat. Because when he and his three friends had been planning this expedition, they hadn't factored in the fact that all of Italy might gang up against them.
Are you kidding me?
He didn't dare leave by sea to Marseille, since he'd left it too late. He might have got away if he'd gone earlier, but now the Venetian fleet were on their way from the Adriatic, and the Spanish fleet were lurking in Sicily.
Yes, of course they are.
Hmm. Yeah, they spent too much time, I could say, having fun. I don't think fun is the right word, no. really, is it?
No. Yeah. Creating chaos.
Yes. It was decided that he'd head north with 8,000 horse, 3,000 Swiss, and as many French infantrymen, while the fleet, laden with spoils of war, would follow them up the coast. But still, Charles doesn't seem to be in too much of a hurry, since he was still waiting for the Pope to grant him the investiture of Naples. Presumably he's thinking, well, when I get this investiture, you know, we'll have a big party or something.
And we'll join the League against the Turks.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, yes. Well, I was just thinking, he probably wants the full ceremony, because he came in without any ceremony, because the Neapolitans said, well, hang on a few days and we'll set it all up nicely for you. And he said, no, I'm coming now.
I'm coming now.
Moseyed into town, but perhaps he wants the full, he's been the bridesmaid, he wants to be the bride now.
I can't believe how oblivious he is.
Yeah. Yes. Unless he's extremely clever and calculating, but I don't think he is.
Mm.
It's not the impression. Either he's so clever and calculating that he's completely misled everybody,
mm.
who all thinks, well, he's man's an idiot, or he's an idiot.
Option number two.
He does several times that the Pope had kept putting him off, but this time Alexander was fearful of Charles's march back through Italy, which would inevitably take him through Rome.
Yeah, they're coming back.
Yeah, even though Charles had promised to leave his army outside the city walls.
I promise. Just leave the gates open.
Yeah, I can't imagine that's going to help particularly.
No.
Because suddenly you're at siege. You've got an army outside.
And they've already been through once, so you probably have no food left.
No. No, I should imagine most of Italy is quite short of food.
Yes.
You get the sudden influx of hungry
thousands
people.
Of people eating on their way through with their horses.
Mm-hmm. Trampling everything that they don't eat. But the Pope decided that now he had the League behind him, he could bite the bullet and tell Charles that A, he wasn't the King of Naples and never would be.
Uh-oh.
And B, he would not be allowed into Rome.
Uh-oh.
And meanwhile, the Pope was on to his fellow League members, telling them to get over here and help, for God's sake.
Right now. Not tomorrow. Now.
And he also made sure that he got out of Rome himself.
Oh, yeah. Protect himself.
Went to Orvieto with the College of Cardinals and 20,000 horse as protection.
Now there you have no food.
Well, Charles was now angry.
Yeah. I would be too, but he kind of made it himself.
Oh, yeah. He did go to Rome. He arrived on the 1st of June, and he and his army did enter the city, regardless of the wishes of the Pope. So, no more Mr. Nice Guy. Although he did tell his troops not to cause trouble, because he knew better than to alienate everyone in Italy. But a bit belatedly, he realised that was not a good idea.
Yeah.
And amazingly, given how they behaved in Naples, they didn't cause trouble. 2 days later, Charles set off to Orvieto to talk to the Pope. And the Pope went to Perugia. So they're sort of cat-mousing their way across Italy.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and the Pope's not coming out of this very well, I don't think.
No, he's not.
Charles continued northward. He obviously thought, I can't be bothered with the Pope now. Florence reminded him that he'd promised them restitution of Pisa.
Right.
Hmm. There was now all-out war between the two cities. And Florence told Charles that if they didn't get Pisa back, they were going over to the League. And it was only them and Henry VII who wasn't in the League.
Oh, my. Except that he's there with an army and Florence doesn't have one.
They can buy one.
With what money? We listened to Machiavelli before we did this. They have no money.
No, you don't have to pay mercenaries. No, it's fine if you don't pay mercenaries. There's no problem. Savonarola was in charge of Florence. And we've seen before that he was very pro-Charles, believing him to be the sword of God. But Charles now had Piero de' Medici by his side, which was not going to win him friends in Florence.
Nope.
And this wasn't the only political problem that was slowing him down. Several towns had said to him, you know, while you're here, could you adjudicate between these two factions? Or could you help get rid of this hated ruler and it was getting later and later in the year, and he'd hoped to be back in the arms of Anne of Brittany by the end of April. Another problem was whether he should just keep marching and let all those cities he'd taken over to provide himself with a safe route to him from Naples fall out of his hands again, or should he try and retain them by leaving garrisons?
So he's going to get a smaller and smaller army as he goes.
Yes, it's going to be him and a friend by the end of it.
How did he think he was going to keep them? He must have... Please tell me he had a plan on how to retain all these conquests before they even left France.
It sounds very unlikely that there was a lot of planning. I'm not getting a feeling of a lot of planning.
So he now has to decide that all of that conquest that he got is either going to go back to themselves, back to their normal rulers, or he has to leave so much behind that he won't actually get out of Italy.
Yeah, it's not an easy choice to make.
Well, no, it's a definitive choice. I need to get back to France. They're all going to have to come with me.
Well, Comines, who'd rejoined Charles in Siena, he was horrified to see that it was those who wanted to hang on to the cities that had the king's ear.
Oh, dear.
He felt that Charles wasn't seeing the danger. As he'd keep saying, look, really, we have to hurry. And he just feels that he's not getting it. He's begging him to get a move on. The League had 40,000 men, but they weren't ready yet. You know, get a move on, and you can be out of here before they turn up.
And with the way that politics happens in Europe, they may never show up.
Yes.
Especially since Maximilian is part of it.
Well, any of them, really. I wouldn't trust any of them. Well, poor old Comines must have felt like Cassandra, since he's also saying, restore the Florentine towns, and then Florence will give you money with which you can pay your troops. If you don't do it, you'll have two more enemies to add to your list.
But Florence doesn't have any money.
Florence and your own troops, which you won't have paid.
And Cassandra, by the way, is from a Greek myth that she was a prophetess who actually saw the future, but nobody would listen to her.
Yep.
Yeah.
Also, he said, please don't keep Siena, because it was under the aegis of the Holy Roman Empire. Do you really want to antagonise Maximilian any further?
Yeah, you've already taken his wife and then rejected his daughter.
Yeah, so he's not your bestest friend. Please just don't turn him into your deadliest enemy.
Isn't he already? Would be my question.
Charles set off again on the 17th of June, but he still had this problem of Florence and Pisa hanging over him. And it was his fault. He had made promises to Pisa.
Yes,
he had. But he had made the opposite promises to Florence.
Florence, yes, he had.
He promised Florence that the French would hang on to Pisa and Livorno while they were there and then hand them back to Florence when they were going back to France. But as far as the Pisans were concerned, Charles had freed them from what they called, quote, an Egyptian servitude, unquote.
What did they mean by that?
The Egyptians treated the Hebrews very, very badly, didn't they? Florentines are treating the Pisans very, very badly. And I wonder, when they call him Charles the Affable, is that because he was incapable of saying no? He just was all things to all people. And it was getting him into trouble.
Well, he's definitely in trouble.
It didn't help matters that the Cardinal of Saint-Malo had accepted an advance from the Florentines. And Savonarola was issuing dire warnings about what God thought about people who didn't uphold their bargains. But Charles just couldn't make up his mind, and he still hadn't when they actually reached Pisa. He had advisers on both sides, but what clinched it was that his men came to him and said that they'd been listening to the stories of misery from the Pisans, and if Charles valued his men at all, he would free Pisa from the tyranny of Florence. The men even offered to forgo their pay if it was money that Charles was worried about.
Really?
And then some lovely Pisan ladies threw themselves at his feet and begged him not to forsake Pisa. So, you know, that was that. Because we know what a soft-hearted old thing Charles is. With the ladies. Comines wasn't happy. And he also wasn't happy when he advised against Charles' plan to attack Genoa.
I wonder how he feels, because he left Charles of Burgundy when he was frustrated with him because he was never listening to go to Charles VIII.
Do you think Philippe has a really sort of weedy, whiny voice, so that whenever he tells anybody something, they just sort of mentally switch off.
You shouldn't be
doing that. That's a really bad idea. And you think, did someone say something?
And now he's like, why did I leave Burgundy? At least I was safe there.
Anyway, the attack on Genoa was a complete disaster, just as Philippe had said it would be. And it resulted in the loss of many troops that Charles was really going to need if he was going to get out of Italy alive.
Mm.
While this was going on, the allies of the League were amassing.
Oh, they actually were getting people together?
Yeah, they're getting together. Yeah, it's happening. And they're not going to attack the Turks, obviously, but they can get it together to attack the French. Venice sent an army to Lombardy. Ludovico was setting up an army. Bentivoglio di Bologna suddenly remembered that he was on the League side when his sons were given a military command and the other one was made a cardinal.
Yeah, we've always been with the League.
Yes. But Charles was very lucky that his route was free of enemies. Comines reckoned that a few men with guns could have stopped the French in their tracks. So it's no wonder he believes that Charles must have God on his side, because he keeps, apart from this Genoa thing, he keeps saying to him, it's all going to be a disaster. Oh, how on earth did you manage to get through that?
What the heck? This should never have been able to happen.
I know I'm right about this, and yet you still keep managing to get through.
Yeah. I'm wondering how this is happening.
Hmm.
Because it's not like you're coming through unscathed. You've just lost a bunch of men.
Yeah.
But you're still able, like, what the heck?
Hmm. He has God on his side. I mean, what more can you say?
His horse has four lucky horseshoes.
At Pontremoli, there was an altercation on their outward journey, and 40 Swiss mercenaries had been killed. The Swiss were bent on revenge now that they were back in the city, and they ran amok, killing, pillaging, and eventually setting the whole place on fire. And it had the unfortunate side effect that several of their own people were burnt because they'd passed out drunk in the cellars.
Oh my goodness!
And also, all their provisions got wiped out in the flames.
Of course they did.
The French were about to enter an inhospitable region, both in the sense of not being able to forage for food, and now being refused food by the people who were justifiably miffed that Pontremoli was no more.
Oh my goodness.
Then they had the problem of what to do with the cannons they brought with them, because they were now understaffed to lug them. You know, quite a lot of them having been killed in Genoa.
Okay, wait. Do we have a count so far of how many he brought in with him into Italy and where he is about now with how many people? He's got two?
He's got about 10,000.
Still.
He brought in 30,000.
Gosh.
But he has been, you know, leaving them on the way. I don't mean just sort of abandoned.
Oh, dead. Okay.
I mean, you've got garrisons. Some of them are in Florence. Some of them are in Naples. Some of them are not well.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it.
They didn't have enough horses for these guns, and yet they couldn't abandon them because it was the big guns that had given them the edge on their journey down Italy. Even just the threat of them. So the Swiss, who were feeling just a tiny bit guilty at having set fire to all their provisions, offered themselves as draft animals.
I'm sorry, what? They were going to drag them?
Mm-hmm. They harnessed themselves, there were over 100 to each cannon. These things must have been massive. And dragged them to Fornovo. Well, it turned out that it's all been a complete waste of time and effort. A smaller part of the French army were already there, and had been for a few days, and it was through a shameful lack of military tactics that the Allies didn't wipe them out while they had the chance.
Wait a second. The Swiss decided to be pack animals for these cannons.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they just handle the horses and let the horses
There weren't
the
enough
pack
horses.
Animals?
There's not enough horses to
Oh, not
them.
Enough. Well, where are the other horses? Can't they just kick everybody onto their foot? Like, you don't ride the horse. We'll use the horse to pull the cannons.
I don't think there's a lot of... I don't think there's a lot of horses.
It
all seems to be more like... I'm seeing it more like a sort of exodus of refugees rather than a brave army
force.
Going in with their pennants flying and...
Okay.
the armies often leave for war looking very smart and eager. That's not how they end up coming back, is it? So
no, and I could see why the Swiss would want to say, okay, we'll be back, horses, because if they don't keep the guns with them, they're hooped.
Hmm. Yeah, and I should imagine the French were saying, well, thank you very much. We now don't have anything to eat, do we?
Oh, yeah.
And I suppose it might have stopped a sort of mutiny or civil war within the army. The French arrived in Fornovo on the 5th of July, and they found it abandoned by the Italian allies and full of food and wine and fodder for the horses. And after their deprivation of the previous days, which they have been, they haven't had anything to eat, and they've been marching and pulling these damn cannons along with them, they were tempted to fall on it and start stuffing their faces.
Oh.
Well, then someone said, what if it's poisoned? Surely it must be poisoned, otherwise why would they have left it here? Then two Swiss soldiers couldn't resist, at least they couldn't resist the wine, and they died.
Yeah.
But they had drunk enough to fill a horse, so there was no way of knowing still whether it was poisoned or not. The French did manage to buy a bit of overpriced food from neighbouring villages, but otherwise they just had to content themselves with just looking longingly at all that food with their bellies rumbling.
Somebody's got to be desperate enough to try it.
Well, apparently it seems not. They all just sat and looked at it.
Oh,
I don't know. I suppose you'd think, well, it's not worth the risk, and when we set off, there's bound to be lots more.
You ate it all the way down.
The French then sent Comines over to the Phoenicians to discuss the possibility of peace. They do seem to send him quite often, so maybe this whiny voice really is getting on their nerves. They're thinking, oh, somebody send him somewhere, for goodness sake. Oh, you shouldn't be doing this. Comines was reluctant to go, since he thought the Allies would probably see it as fear on the part of the French. And he was received rather rudely, which annoyed him.
They don't like his voice either.
He was told that if and only if Charles gave Ludovico back the town of Novara, and if he gave the Pope back the church lands, would he be allowed to go home peacefully? Comines replied that if the Allies didn't let them through, the French were perfectly capable of hacking their way through anyone who got in their way.
No, they aren't. Fight and talk.
Comines was horrified to hear from the Cardinal of Saint-Malo that the plan, he seems to be a liability, that the plan was for the French to just march past the army. They'd fire off a few cannons as a mark of strength, but otherwise they'd just walk past doing their best to ignore all the thousands of enemy soldiers.
What?
Just don't make eye contact. Pretend we're on a bird-watching trip. And Comines thought and said that it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Don't do it.
It's going to work.
The Allies wouldn't just stand there and watch them go past.
Please tell me they don't.
He was wondering who was putting these ideas into the king's head. Comines and the Cardinal of Saint-Malo were sent out the next day to talk terms with the Allies. But while they were on their way, a shot rang out from the Venetian side and was met by a volley of fire from the French side. So it was too late. Mm. I mean, you've got to fight now. Once you've done that, that's it. You've got to fight. So the following day, both sides were prepared for battle. One of Charles's captains said to him, quote, "Sire, I have often heard you say that your great desire was to take part in a big fine battle. Behold, your wish is fulfilled," unquote. Mm. To which Charles replied, quote, "You speak truly." They are speaking like a really bad film, aren't they?
Yeah.
"You speak truly. They outnumber us by 10-1, but we must force our way through the midst of them. Today shall I learn who are my friends, and with them I go forth to live or to die," unquote.
What the heck?
But everyone's commented on the change in him. He seems to have sort of grown, because, you know, he was this puny man that left France.
Yes.
Well, he's just... seems to have grown in stature, and he did have a sort of halting, stuttery voice. Well, now he's declaiming all over the place. It really seems to have been the making of him, this trip.
Goodness.
But he had just taken his troops into a situation where they were hugely outnumbered, extremely unpopular, and still far from home. So, not great leadership skills.
No.
And I don't think it was his first battle, because he did fight in the Breton Wars. But we'll hear about that in Anne of Beausejour's episode. So, with those odds against them, how did the French manage to win?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Since to cut a long, brutal story short, they did win, sort of. I mean, they had God on their side. That helped. There was a lack of discipline in the Italian ranks. We hear this all the time, don't we? And a lack of expertise in their officers, which is odd. I mean, the Italians are fighting all the time.
Yes.
Why are they so rubbish at it? But one of the main reasons was that part of the Italian force made for the French baggage train, since they suddenly realised they were quite close to it, and it was there for the taking. So why not break from the middle of a battle and have a bit of a rummage in the baggage train?
Oh, there must be
all sorts of goodies in there. And other men then saw what was happening and, thinking about all those spoils of war, decided that they didn't want their comrades getting it all. So they all ran off to the baggage train. And you can't have half your army running after a baggage train and still have a viable force. And it was said of the Italian army that they then began to, quote, rely more on their horse and their spurs than on their hands and their swords, unquote. In other words, they ran away. They made for the river, which had been swollen by the lashing rain that had been going on throughout the battle. Because you can't have a battle without lashing rain, it seems. I don't know if they wait for the weather forecast and think, that Tuesday sounds really grim, let's do it then. Those who were not cut down on their way to the river were soon drowned trying to cross it. The carnage might have been worse, but the rain made the cannons, you know, the ones that the Swiss had dragged all that way, completely unusable. So, complete waste of time.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to describe the battle any more than that, because, I mean, there are quite a few military history podcasts, and at least one of them must have done Fonovo. I'm not very interested in that sort of pincer movement and left flank pit.
No. That's very visual. You almost need a board with a bunch of little pieces that you can show by video what's going
on.
Yeah,
I think that might be quite fun.
Yeah, trying to describe it is a little more difficult.
Yes.
Yes.
But if you are into that, then feel free to look elsewhere. But
go away.
But we're a biographical podcast, so we're more interested in how Charles conducted himself. Well, he got right in there. He's been criticised for being a tad foolhardy, given that he was king. He should have been keeping himself safe. When the Italians fled, Charles was on the battlefield all alone except for a valet de chambre, quote, a small man and ill-armed, unquote. Now, this must be a trope. Why would the king be right in the middle of a battlefield all on his own with his valet de chambre?
Never.
He was spotted by part of the Italian army which hadn't fled, and they came galloping down the field towards him. Unfortunately, a group of his lords saw what was happening and galloped over to help the king, but for a while Charles was having to fight them off on his own, or at least with his small, ill-armed man. And you think, again, really? This is one of those... you know, he's the king, he's got to have his moment of glory. I expect he was probably fighting them off single-handed, wasn't he? Oh, I don't remember. Yes, he was. Do you remember? Oh, yes. Yes, he did. So I don't believe it.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
The battle could have so easily gone the other way if they got him. The battle was an example of the different fighting styles of the Italians and the French, because the Italians, as we've heard many times, relied for a long time on the condottieri, mercenaries, and as we've said many times, mercenaries are there for money and not for glory or patriotism. The French were fighting for their lives. If they lost that battle, they wouldn't be able to get back to France. They had a lot more at stake, and it makes a big difference. Well, they may have won, sort of, but the French had no provisions since their baggage train had been taken. And they had nowhere to shelter. The king found a farmhouse to sleep in, along with the wounded and the sick. And Comyn had to sleep in a vineyard, and he was cursing that he'd lent the king his cloak that morning and Charles hadn't given it back.
That's so ridiculous.
Yes. They'd lost more than food in the baggage train. Spoils to the value of at least 100,000 ducats. The king's sword and helmet, Makes you wonder why he didn't have his sword and helmet with him in the middle of a battle. What was it doing in the baggage train? Royal pavilions, the king's prayer book and relics, and worst of all, an album full of the portraits of the king's mistresses. His little back book.
He took that with him?
Oh, everywhere. Because most of the mistresses he'd had on tour. So not something to take home to show the missus, I don't think. These are all the women I've had while I've been in Italy, dear.
Okay.
But because they gained the spoils of war, the Allies tried to make out that they'd won the battle. And that was the news that swept across Italy. But Charles and his army were able to continue on their way, and since the battle was fought to stop them, the Allies didn't really win. They got stuff, which is nice, I suppose. The news was even put about that the king was among the dead. But the whole thing must have been a shock for the Allies, because they had far superior numbers.
Yeah, what the heck happened? What is going on?
Well, they'd expected to wipe the French from the face of the earth.
Yes, but I expected that too.
No. The condottieri, Forti Braccio, strong arm. It's a good name for a condottieri. Do you remember we came across one called Honey Cat, which is not such a good name for a condottieri. A nice name for a cat, but not a condottieri. Anyway, strong arm, Forti Braccio, said, quote, "I must say this, for I cannot keep it back. We could have defeated this army, or even a larger one, if our people had attended to the battle and not to the baggage train," unquote. Yes, he's obviously saying, look, I've got to say this. No, it's just going to niggle at me if I don't actually say it out loud. Comyn was sent over to the Italian camp to negotiate, and he asked that the prisoners should be well treated, although the Italians couldn't ask the same, since the French hadn't taken any prisoners, but killed everyone that they could. Which is, again, how the French and Italian fighting styles definitely favour the French. It's a lot quicker to kill people than to take them off the battlefield.
Yeah,
I don't know where you put them while you're doing that. I mean, do people
And
say,
who guards them? So you'd be losing men to the battle in order to guard people you're capturing.
Yeah, unless there's a code of chivalry that once you're off the battlefield, you just stand there like a chess piece or something that's been taken off.
Go sit over there and have a picnic and just watch your friends. Yeah.
The king wanted to leave Montferrat behind to continue the negotiations, but Montferrat said, quote, he had no liking for getting himself killed with his eyes open, unquote. And no way were they going to leave him behind. So that was that. They left early, and the Italians were still waiting for the resumption of negotiations. And it was only at midday that they suddenly realised, oh, they buggered off. They were still waiting. That's complete fiasco.
It's a disaster in such a stupid way.
Yes. And this is the big one, the Battle of Fornovo, the big famous battle. Absolutely ridiculous. Once the French reached Piacenza, they nearly ruined everything because some of their party crossed the Trebbia River, which was at that point little more than a stream. But what with all the rain, it suddenly rose and became impassable. So the bulk of the troops with 6 guns were on one side and the rest, the 200 lancers and the Swiss, were on the other side. And Piacenza had been taken over by Ludovico's troops. So they're sitting targets now.
Yeah.
They've been divided. Easy. But the Milanese didn't do it. They didn't attack. And it's another example of the French being ridiculously lucky. And the Milanese can't have been popular since the locals secretly gave the French provisions. So, yeah, it's just madness. Why didn't they attack?
I don't know.
I wondered if they were worried that their troops would go over to the French side as well.
Why?
If Ludovico was that unpopular, then any way to get Ludovico out.
They'd be willing.
But then why get the army together in the first place if you don't trust them to fight?
Well.
Or maybe it's the old story. Maybe they haven't been paid. So they said, nope, we're not going till we get paid.
Yeah.
On the 16th of July, the French troops had reached the safety of Asti, where at last they had enough to eat that they could be sure hadn't been poisoned. They'd covered 125 miles in 8 days, after a battle and on very little, if any, food, sleeping out in the open and marching in hot, wet weather. The only thing they had to drink was from puddles and ditches. But Comyn said he never heard a word of complaint from the men. And I was thinking that's probably because they can see that the officers are in the same situation. I mean, if you've got the officers on horseback and staying in palaces while you're sleeping out in the rain, you're going to feel a sense of grievance. But if you're all in the same boat, who are you going to complain to?
Yeah.
It's raining, Charles. I know, I'm wet. In the rest of Italy, there was great rejoicing because the Venetians had put quite a spin on the Battle of Fornovo, and everyone thought they'd won. So bells were rung and bonfires were lit, and the Pope sent out a papal bull complaining that Charles had come to Rome and his men had committed atrocities. He'd gone off with the brother of the Turkish tyrant, that's Prince Cem, who we'll hear about, who had died in his custody. He had refused the Pope's proposal for a crusade. Yeah. On his way back up from Naples, women and children had been murdered in churches. I don't think there's evidence for this, but there never hurts an argument to chuck in the odd thing like that, does it?
No.
And he behaved worse than the Turk himself. If he kept quiet, the Pope said, he would be like a dog which cannot bite. It is interesting that he waited until he thought the French had been beaten by the Allies and were well on their way before he decided he was going to bare his teeth to Charles. Yes.
He's like that little chihuahua that growls behind its mama's leg. Yes.
Yeah, and another thing, he's fat and ugly. Yes. Charles wrote to the Pope saying, "What are you talking about? We won, not you." But people preferred to believe what they preferred to believe.
Yes.
Meanwhile, Louis of Orléans was still at siege in Navarra, and the Milanese and Venetian armies were heading his way. And could someone do something about it, please, as they were starving to death in Navarra?
Oh, dear.
Because the water had been diverted away from Navarra. Because if you remember, that's why Navarra had let the French in the first place, because Ludovico had diverted the water to help another city, not taking into consideration that that water had to come from somewhere, and it came from Navarra. But that now meant that Louis and his troops and the good citizens of Navarra had very little to drink. Ludovico was all for letting nature take its course and starving them out, since it was his city and the last thing he wanted was for it to be shot to smithereens. The Venetians, though, they were much more economically pragmatic. They pointed out that this siege was costing 100,000 ducats a month. Come on, let's go on and destroy it.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money,
yeah. A month.
And life outside wasn't much better. Disease was running through the Allied armies too, and the men, especially the lanzknechts, were getting mutinous.
I would be too.
Yeah, I'd have gone. I'd have left by then. This went on until winter. But what was Charles doing all this time? Why hadn't he got troops together to relieve Louis of Orléans? Some historians have said it was out of sight, out of mind. He'd moved on to Chieri, where he was in the process of seducing his host's daughter, and hadn't really given Louis much thought. But this may well be unfair on Charles. There were many difficulties to overcome to relieve Navarra, because his troops were exhausted and ill. I mean, I'm not sure how much of this illness was our old chum syphilis, and how much was malaria, and how much was lack of food and rest on their journey. And his troops were deserting. Now that they weren't a million miles away from France, many of the men were tempted just to call it a day and head home.
Gosh.
There was no money to convince the troops to engage in another battle.
You didn't pay them in the first place.
No. And the enemy outnumbered him 3-1. It had been an exceptionally rainy summer and autumn, and the whole place was like a quagmire.
Oh, wow.
So historians might be being unfair to Charles, saying he was living only for pleasure and didn't really care about Louis. He might have weighed up the pros and cons and thought it wasn't worth risking the lives of his troops to save Louis's troops.
Oh, goodness. But what about Louis?
Would he be any great loss to Charles?
It is his only heir at this moment.
He has a son.
Does he?
Hmm. But it does show what sort of reputation he had that people might suggest such a thing. Also, although I didn't read this anywhere, but Louis had rather dobbed himself in it. He had taken Navarra and had then got himself besieged. Some may have thought that he'd made his bed and he should lie in it.
Oh, jeez. Let's just leave him be. Yes. He'll figure it out.
It's his own damn fault. Against these odds, Comines stressed to Charles the need for peace and to release Louis. And to this end, eventually, an agreement was made between the French and Ludovico. So it seems very sensible. Charles was thinking, well, how are we going to attack Navarra? How are we going to attack the people besieging Navarra and get Louis out? And Comines was saying, we don't have to. We just need to make peace. Oh, sorry. We don't have to. We just need to. Sorry, what did you say? Ludovico would supply ships to carry French reinforcements to Naples. I don't know why. He would not allow any of his men to fight for the Aragonese, and Charles's men should have safe passage through Ludovico's lands. So Ludovico's back with Charles again.
God, that man.
Yeah. I mean, there's the leagues beginning to crumble. Charles would pay back money that had been lent to him. Well, you know, if it's been lent to him, he should anyway, I'd have thought. You don't have to put that in a treaty. And should compensate Ludovico for the cost of his expenditure to Navarra, namely 50,000 ducats. Navarra would become Ludovico's, so everyone's happy. But there was more, but that was the gist.
Okay.
There's no mention of getting Milan for Louis of Orleans, which shows that although Charles made out that he intended to help Louis, it's not that high up his to-do list.
He had no intention.
Soon after, however, Ludovico was happily ignoring the terms of the treaty. You wouldn't expect anything else, would you?
No. Oh,
Louis and his men were released from Navarra looking skeletal. It said they looked like spectres of men. Mm. Many of them died on the way to Asti. Comines saved some of them by feeding them soup. Some died from overindulgence because their poor emaciated bodies just couldn't do it anymore. Sudden influx of food. Charles had done rather better out of this deal than Ludovico had, and there was a reason for that. Swiss mercenaries, 20,000 of them. Louis had promised them all sorts of things when he became Duke of Milan. And this was enough for Ludovico to say, fine, have your ships, have your safe passage, just keep those mercenaries away from Milan.
Ah.
Louis still hoped to become Duke of Milan, but Charles slapped him on the wrist and said, never mind about Milan, you're coming home with me, my lad. Yeah, I presume that he had just got all these concessions out of Ludovico. He didn't want Louis jeopardising them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure what Louis had promised these mercenaries since he was perennially short of money, and obviously he'd just been besieged. But what they were expecting, though, was a fight. When they heard there'd been a truce, they started to get nasty. Charles had been getting money from taxes from France and from his new kingdom of Naples. Well, France had decided no longer to fund Charles's campaign, and Naples had been so mismanaged that nothing was coming from there either. They were in a scary position.
Oh, gosh.
Louis of Orléans said, quote, it is no small thing to have on one's hands 25,000 Swiss without having the money to pay them, unquote. And he was borrowing from rich locals at huge rates of interest to keep the Swiss from going feral. Mind you, I suppose it was in the locals' benefit that they shouldn't go feral either.
Feral's such a weird term. They were domesticated.
Yes.
Gone feral.
Yes. It was all right for Charles because he was making his preparations to go home. And in fact, he was back in Lyon on the 7th of November, 15 months after he'd left.
He made it all the way back.
He made it back.
How?
I don't know how he made it down there. I don't know how he made it back.
No. It makes no sense.
No.
But he's probably looking at everybody who told him he couldn't do it and going, huh? Huh? Yeah? Hmm? See?
It's me. Yes. Yeah, you said it couldn't happen, but look at me now.
Yeah, I ended up with nothing, but yes. I got there and I came back.
Yeah, we're not quite nothing.
Veni, vidi, veneri. I came, I saw, I got a horrible disease. Thank you, Terry Pratchett.
But what had been happening in Naples since Charles had left? He'd been worrying about the, quote, fine men, unquote, that he'd left behind. And, well, he should have been. There weren't very many of them. There were about 10,000, which is not that many when you consider the Naples took up about half of Italy.
Yeah.
Many were ill, and the French had made themselves very unpopular. And it might be seen as a sign of Charles's statesmanship that while he was in Naples, many of the Neapolitan nobles feigned allegiance to him, but when he left, they went straight back to the Aragonese. Or you could say that it was might just be that Charles took most of the army with him so that they didn't weren't outnumbered anymore. There was very little money and an inadequate supply of weapons. They were led by Gilbert de Montpensier, a man who was renowned for not getting up till lunchtime.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a man who takes his job very seriously.
Good choice.
On the 20th of May, the very day that Charles left Naples, Ferentino was sailing over from Sicily. And Ferentino, remember, is now the Aragonese king of Naples. One by one, the cities he passed through opened their gates to him. And when you think that this family had tyrannised the area, it just shows how awful the French had been. A week later, Ferentino was joined by Gonsalvo de Cordoba, el gran capitán. Olé.
Olé!
They didn't bring many men with them, but as they went along, they did what Perkin Warbeck and John de la Pole had hoped to do, because people came flocking to them.
Yeah.
But the French weren't entirely without friends. Unbeknownst to Ferentino and Cordoba, who weren't really keeping an eye on the French because they felt their numbers were so pitifully small they weren't a great worry, the French had managed to amass quite a sizeable army, including a contingent of Swiss mercenaries. Is there anybody left in Switzerland, do you think?
No. Nope.
No. This actually proved to be a disastrous encounter for the so-called Grand Capitan.
Really?
Yeah, when fighting the Moors in Granada, the Spaniards had picked up their trick of pretending to run away and then suddenly turning around and attacking.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, on this occasion, Cordoba omitted to tell his allies what he was planning to do.
So they just assumed he was actually running away.
They were watching him running away, as far as they thought. So they ran away too.
Oh, dear.
Ferentino was straight off that battlefield and straight on a boat sailing to Sicily with Cordoba not far behind him.
Mm, well done.
So much for a grand capitan. Olé. It was a pity the French let them go. But the commander wasn't well and had been brought into the battle in a litter. Or maybe it's just he didn't want to get out of bed till 12 o'clock. I don't know. Perhaps the battle took place in the morning and he said, no, you just have to bring the bed with us.
This is ridiculous.
If he had been well, they might have routed the fleeing army. But they didn't, and they would rue the day. Ferentino was back on the 6th of July. That's the day after the Battle of Fornovo. As Ferentino approached the capital, Montpensier marched his men out of the city of Naples to confront him. And no sooner were they all out than the Neapolitans shut the door.
Goodbye! Clock.
Montpensier was left in an impossible situation. He didn't want to go into battle with a mutinous town behind him. But he couldn't go back into that town because it was mutinous. So he had to run round the back, to run round the walls and sneak in through another entrance.
This feels like an unwanted party guest. It's that ridiculous. Okay, you won't let me in the front door. Hold on, I'll just climb the fence and, oh, the back door's open. Hello!
Well, not just that, but you've got an army coming at you, and so the people are saying, we can't get back in! Let us in! And they have quick round the back! Come on, everybody, quick! I'm getting the Benny Hill music now.
Yeah!
Meanwhile, Ferentino entered the city at the front door in triumph. And Montpensier entered the city, the back door, in triumph. Not really in triumph, because Montpensier entered the castle there, only to find himself instantly besieged. He'd just done a Louis of Orleans. He just said to them, let's go into this enclosed space. What could possibly go wrong? Mm. There were other French contingents around who took on Ferentino and Cordoba, but Montpensier was besieged for 3 months. And the castle hadn't held much of provisions anyway. It was agreed with the Italians that if reinforcements hadn't arrived to bolster the French numbers in 2 months, they would leave and go back to France.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it seems... Okay, we're not going now, but if we get more people... But if it doesn't work out, we'll go. Is that all right? And for chance of, well, I suppose nope. So.
We don't.
Seems an odd way to do it, but okay.
Yeah.
A division was heading his way under Pressey, and it was bringing provisions, cattle, and guns to relieve the beleaguered fortress. But they met overwhelming numbers of enemy troops, so they turned round and left Montpensier to his fate.
You're on your own!
Yeah, I think I'd be spending all day in bed by this point.
Jeez!
By 17th February 1496, the Aragonese had the whole capital, and news of the fall of the capital encouraged the rest of the Kingdom of Naples to abandon the French. And to get out of this situation, the French needed money and an effective navy, but unfortunately, they didn't have either
they
of those things.
Either.
No. But Ferentino's side wasn't much better off. They had about the same number of men and the same lack of money, and it seemed that the winner would be the first one to enlist the support of a powerful outsider. Because you know how well that goes when you get a powerful outsider involved.
Oh, goodness. Now we belong to you.
Yay. So the winner was Ferentino, since he put Naples under Venetian protection. And Venice offered Ferentino no more, they said. They seem to be very pragmatic people, the Venetians. I quite like them. No more than 200,000 ducats a year. And in that same way that Henry VII had made terms with Brittany, Venice secured Brindisi, Otranto and Trani if Naples defaulted on the repayment, which they probably hoped they would, really.
Yeah.
And that was good for Aragon. But in the meantime, the French had had good luck. As reinforcements had arrived, 2,000 men, largely Swiss mercenaries, arrived by sea.
Wow.
And the Orsini family switched sides again and pledged allegiance to France, bringing a sizable army with them. And it'd be interesting to look at the Orsini sometime and wonder why they can't stick to a side.
None of them do, though.
No, but the Orsini do seem to be uncanny. It just seems to be, you know, they must wake up in the morning and think, whose side are we on today? Ferentino was still waiting for that Venetian aid, and the French were sweeping through, taking fortresses and cities. Then the Venetians arrived and the scales were evenly balanced again. But they were both short of money, because I suppose they must have used the money they got from the Venetians to gain more troops. But it's never enough, is it? I mean, mercenaries are a bottomless pit.
Yes.
And then we go to mutinous, just for a change. So after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, Montpensier again found himself besieged, this time with a couple of thousand unpaid Swiss mercenaries who were threatening to go over to the other side. So I thought it's a bit like being locked in a cupboard with a tiger, isn't it?
Yes.
Before he was besieged with his own troops. You know, not nice, but, you know, doable. Now he's besieged by...
by his own troops.
Yes. Huh. Ferentino got them to leave. This is bizarre. He got them to leave by giving them a loan of 10,000 ducats. What sort of siege is it where the besieger pays the besiegees to go?
With a loan, though.
Yeah. You pay off the people inside the fortress whom you were just trying to starve out. I don't think I've come across that before.
No.
Maybe that's a very Italian thing. We never sort it out with money.
Hmm.
Anyway, it worked. Montpensier marched his men to the coast, where they hung around hoping that some ships might turn up. And then an epidemic of malaria swept through the exhausted and emaciated army. 5,000 men arrived on that coast, and a few hundred made it back to France. Montpensier himself succumbed, and then soon after Ferentino died of it too, and was succeeded by his uncle Federigo. I wonder how long it took for them to realise that Montpensier had died of it and they just thought he was having a lie-in, maybe. I don't know, it's been days now. This effectively put an end to Neapolitan opposition to the Aragon rule.
I'm just wondering, all the peasantry and the merchants are just sitting there, shaking their heads, wondering, how did you end up in charge? For all of this, every single one of these people, honestly, have any of you made a sensible decision? Not one.
I think we've said that about everybody, though, haven't we? What do you do if you've been told, okay, you've got to leave? I mean, I suppose you'd march back up through Italy, but then they're probably told, well, no, the League have got got an army now, and you're not going to make it marching through Italy. Your only hope is to go by sea, and so they just have to stand there and wait for someone to come.
Mm.
Well, they all die. It's very strange. Anyway, this succession of Uncle Federigo effectively put an end to the Neapolitan opposition to the Aragon rule, because Federico was known to be gentle and chivalrous and not tyrannical like the rest of his family. So he was someone that everyone in Naples could get behind. So that's it for the French. They've just lost Naples. And largely because the new king of Naples was not as bad as the rest had been. And certainly not as bad as the French had been.
You spent all that money, all that time, and all the lives mm-hmm. of the men,
yep.
everybody you killed on the way down, mm-hmm. to end up with nothing.
Nope. Nothing. But memories. Memories.
Affable is not the choice of name I would be picking.
No. No, I don't think this is the story that he's telling at home. He's telling that story about he was in the middle of the battlefield with just his small, one, small ill-armed man fighting an entire
one-armed
army.
Man.
I nearly did, yes. Yeah. Anyway, back to Charles. What's he been up to while this has been going on? Well, he's back in France. So some said he lost interest in Italy as soon as he got home. But it's hard to tell. While he was travelling down Italy, he was always a threat to someone, so people wrote about him. But once he gets back to France, it goes a bit quiet, because I suppose it's just not as exciting, so people don't write about him as much. Certainly, the Italians expected him to return and were on tenterhooks waiting. But there were many reasons for him not to do so, because he'd have to start from scratch again. He'd have to build a navy, enlist an army, spend vast amounts of money on Swiss mercenaries. And where was the money to come from? Because France had never liked this Italian venture. It was Charles who wanted Naples, not France. Also, before, Charles had entered Italy with some states for him and some against. Now he'd be going in with a league of allies lined up against him. The French were sick of forking out money for a war they never wanted. So once Charles had paid off his Swiss mercenaries, he was pretty much skint. Letters show that Charles had wanted to relieve Montpensier when he heard that he was besieged. He had asked Pierre Peugeot, what's the quickest way to raise 70,000 francs? But I don't know what Beaujeu replied, but whatever it is, Charles must have sort of given a Gallic shrug. Boff. It ain't happening. To get money, Charles had agreed with Florence that for a loan of 100,000 ducats, they could have Pisa back. So selling back the city he promised to protect to the city who had tyrannised it. So not Charles's finest hour. But that plan was scuppered by Charles's own men saying, no, we're not doing it. We might have raped and pillaged and put whole cities to the sword, but come on, this isn't right.
Oh, goodness. Oh.
And a contingency had been left behind in Pisa, and they'd always been sympathetic to the Pisan cause, because some of them had married Pisan women, including the commander, Dontrag, his name is. So when Charles's troops had arrived to take the city back for Florence, Dontrag had pointed the guns at them, his own side. And on New Year's Day, 1496, Dontrag handed the city to the Pisan authorities, and the same went for Genoa and Lucca. So Charles can forget that 100,000 ducats from Florence.
Oh my goodness.
But it is extraordinary that the soldiers all said, no, this is an atrocity too far.
Yeah.
You know, we'll pay for it. But maybe this gave Charles the chance to say, look, I've done all I can to help. But, you know, I can't do it. And he just had to leave his men in Naples to their fate. It's too late anyway, because Naples by that point had fallen to the Aragonese. And by that time, Charles had another plan. Never mind Naples. Forget Naples. We've done that. Didn't work. What about Milan? If he could take Milan...
Anything that starts with if, just leave it. Just stop.
No, it's going to be great. You take Milan. Then the port of Genoa. And then, you know, biff, 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 they all fall like dominoes. And eventually, you know, Naples will be one of them.
Fantastic. So great.
He still had some people on his side. The Duke of Ferrara, who didn't think much of his son-in-law, Ludovico, was on his side. Florence, who probably sided with Charles because it was too late for them to side with anyone else. I don't suppose they'd let them in the league now. So you had your chance. The Orsini family, Cardinal Della Rovere. So all of those are on the French side. Also, Ludovico was extremely unpopular, as we've said, not just with his father-in-law, but with everybody else. And in fact, he was so unpopular that his subjects shut their gates to his army, but flung them open to the French. So this was Charles' new dream. We're going to go in and take Milan because he's so unpopular. But the Venetians stepped in. They didn't like Ludovico either, but they had put a lot of effort into getting rid of the French, and they were damned if they were going to let them back in now. And the French had another problem. The idea was that Milan would be taken by Louis of Orléans. The Milanese, hating Sforza and seeing someone with a better right to the position, would surely just hand the lands over, as they probably would have done, except for one thing. Louis wouldn't go.
Yep.
No, I'm not going. So Charles's little son had just died. And Charles himself was looking a bit peaky. Mm-hmm. Louis was the heir. He didn't want to be on this other side of the Alps should Charles suddenly peg it.
He needs to be in France to take the crown.
You do. Charles is being menaced on all sides. Ferdinand had amassed troops on France's southern border. Maximilian was trying to get together funds, obviously, to take Burgundy. So I assume that the Treaty of Senlis hadn't given him all of it and he's looking for a bit more. And then in July 1496, Henry VII joined the League of Venice.
Dun, dun, dun.
Henry VII, remember him? He could see France becoming too powerful. And since he was squeezed between France and France's ally Scotland, he felt he had to do something about it. And it was said that although Henry was in favour of peace with France, yet, quote, if he saw her up to her neck in water, he would put his foot on her head to drown her, unquote. And this must have been a serious blow to Charles. Even though Henry VII didn't have to say that he'd invade France to join the League, Isabella of Castile thought that he'd be easy to talk around to the idea.
No.
I'm not sure about that. I don't think he would be.
Only if Isabella's going to pay him.
Yes. But he's already had one sort of fiasco. Not for him. He got lots of money out of it. But it didn't look good when he went back without fighting. I don't think he's going to do it again.
No.
Then Ferdinand proposed a truce with France. And then a prolongation of the truce. And then he tried to get the rest of the League to sign. We went through all this in Ferdinand's episode. But they were worried, A, that it would make France too powerful, and B, where did Ferdinand get off making pacts with France without telling the League until it was a done deal?
Why wasn't I told?
Yes. Nobody speaks to me. Also, the Duke of Estrada was whispering, and that's a Spanish place, was whispering in Charles's ear, both France and Spain have a right to Naples. Why don't they just share it? Spain only wanted the bit of Naples on the other side of the Straits of Messina from Sicily. France could have all the rest. But then when France went to Ferdinand to discuss this proposal, he said that the Duke had no right to say such a thing, so the idea was shelved. Until a time when Ferdinand saw that it would be more favourable to him. He'd almost certainly set the Duke of Estrada up to test the waters, I think. Just go and
find out
this idea to him. And then when he comes to us, I'm going to say no. The League of Venice was falling to pieces. They had fallen out with each other to such an extent that by the spring of 1498, they were all more likely to side with France than to side with each other.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's quite shocking, really, isn't it? Also, in the spring of 1498, Charles was doing up his palace in Amboise. He had hired Italian architects and craftsmen.
That he had met while he was down there pillaging and looting.
Yes. You're coming with me. And He wanted to make his palace a fit place to house the works of art he'd brought back from Italy. And these are presumably the ones, do you remember, there was a load of stuff put on a boat in Naples and sent up that way, because all the other stuff has come back to Italy in the baggage train. His health wasn't great. His doctors kept telling him to cut down on his excesses. And before, he'd ignored this, but Commynes tells us Charles had suddenly wanted to live a holy life. He wanted to reform the church so that a bishop should have only one bishopric and that he should live in the diocese and actually do the job he was being paid for. I mean, shocking.
I can't believe he's actually going to try that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's tried everything else. Let's try this one. He was also giving alms to the poor. And yeah, he seems to have turned over a new leaf.
Why?
I don't know. The fact his health wasn't
great. Is he trying to atone, hoping the syphilis will go away?
Maybe. Maybe. Who was it? It might have been. I know it was Maximilian, who prayed at a shrine for a while and his syphilis went away. So maybe he's heard that and thought, okay, that's all I've got to do, apparently. On Saturday, the 7th of April, you know when we got the actual day that we're getting towards the end, don't you? It's always... Suddenly, we've got the actual day. Saturday, 7th of April, he went out hunting. They always seem to start
hunting.
Off... He went out hunting as well.
No, not this time.
Then he had dinner and visited the Queen in her apartments. He asked his wife to come and watch a tennis match with him. On the way there, he bumped his head on the lintel of a low door. He probably swore a bit, but he was fine, just annoyed. He watched the tennis and chatted with his courtiers. And then suddenly, at around 2 in the afternoon, he fell backwards. He couldn't talk. By nightfall, he was dead. And that's the end of Charles VIII.
You would think he would have died in Italy. But no, he manages to survive all the way through that. And as a joke...
And then bump his head.
As a massive joke to humanity, God takes him out with a bump to the forehead.
It's a bit like Al Capone getting done for tax evasion, isn't it? I mean, it's God seems to be saying, no, I'm going to let you do all that. And then I'll whack you over the head when you get home. Anyway, it's lucky for Louis that he hadn't gone over to Milan.
So do we have any idea? Does anybody have any idea why that would have killed him? Like, what were the steps? It started a brain bleed because he was weak?
Maybe. It can happen, can't it? I mean, if your child bumps its head and is then sick, you rush it off to accident and emergency just in case. It does happen. Scary.
Bumping your head on a low door. What was he doing? Charging head first?
Unless, when you think about his facial features, his protruding eyes and various other things, I wonder, from our description at the beginning, that you said he looked like a frog. I wonder if he might have had brittle head or something, quite a thin skull. I don't know. Huh. I mean, he obviously had various problems. Anyway, we're going to look at Henry VII for a bit and see how all this affected Henry VII and England as a whole, since that's pretty much what we're here for.
Yes.
Charles's triumphal march through Italy led to the formation of the Holy League, briefly. The Pope, Maximilian, Ferdinand, Venice, Milan, and all the other smaller city-states. This kept everyone busy. And this meant that Henry was able to concentrate on his trouble at home. William Stanley, for instance, Perkin Warbeck, Scotland. So he's not being pestered by outside problems. He can concentrate just on that. And it also meant that suddenly everyone's interested in Henry, because they were afraid he'd be lured over to Charles's side, especially since Charles was suddenly being very nice to Henry, including offering to help with the Stop Perkins antics. And suddenly the wedding's back on between Arthur and Catherine. And would that have happened without the impetus of getting Charles out of Italy?
Good question.
And pressure was being put on Maximilian to stop his support for Perkin.
Yes, yes.
Otherwise, Henry wouldn't join the league, and they needed Henry to join the League in case he went over to Charles. Philip had already done that, leading to the Intercursus Magnus. And eventually, Henry was allowed into the Holy League without having to pledge that he'd wage war on France. So desperate were they to keep him away from Charles. So he did quite well there. Because, I mean, the last thing he wants to do is wage war on France. Expensive.
Yeah.
Charles, in the meantime, had tried to buy Perkin from James IV, So keen was he to keep Henry out of the Holy League. So although Charles's march through Italy was hell for the Italians, it couldn't have been better for Henry. An aggressive French king might easily have chosen to push forward his northeastern frontier. The recovery of Calais for France was an obvious ambition. Unfortunately for Henry VII, Charles chose to turn to Italy to assert his claim to the Kingdom of Naples instead. And his Italian ambitions were doubly welcome to the English king. They meant, obviously, the diversion of the French military forces from the Channel coast. And Henry had good reason for knowing that the sea was no sure defence against invasion, since that's precisely what he'd done. In addition, by involving himself in Italy, Charles challenged the Neapolitan claims of Aragon. Ferdinand had little immediate interest in the preservation of England's possession of Calais or her immunity from French invasion, but he recognised that England could be a serious nuisance to his enemy of France, and accordingly decided that her new king's friendship was worth cultivating, even if he wouldn't call him brother.
See Ferdinand's episode.
It was inevitable that efforts should be made to involve England in the network of anti-French alliances, even though their chief concern was with events on the other side of the continent. Nor could Henry VII afford to remain entirely aloof and risk being left isolated against France. So this brought England into the bosom of Europe. Not a place where it's ever very happy, I don't think, but it meant it's not a backwater anymore. It's someone to consider.
That's insane. So this is...
When you think that Charles had handed out all that land at the beginning of this palaver...
To keep everybody out of his way.
Yeah.
He's lost the land and everybody got involved.
Everything's changed, yes.
I am so glad I am not a politician.
Oh, God, no. The death of Charles VIII was marked with due solemnity in England. There wasn't the rejoicing at the death of an enemy. But maybe royalty doesn't do that because, you know, you don't want it to happen to you, really, do you?
Especially when you're probably related to them in some way.
Yeah. So that's that. But I think this man is going to be difficult to rate since I don't know who
he
is.
No kidding.
I mean, I've just been talking about him for over 5 hours and I don't think I know who he is.
I can't tell if... No.
So we're going to give it a go.
Yeah. My face is just concerned.
Amphiboly.
Intrigue. Oh, gosh, it's so hard to tell. Either he is... an innocent abroad, a very lucky innocent abroad, or he's pulled the wool over everyone's eyes and is a very, very clever man. So many people said he can't hold on to one thing at a time.
I'm going back to the very beginning of my notes, and all we have is, he had Perkin, but he didn't use him.
Mm-hmm.
He basically... got taken in whichever direction that the last person who spoke to him told him,
yep.
Or a woman begged him for.
Yes.
And the only real thing you could say and it wasn't even intrigue, was the selling of those lands. After that, it's just...
That seems too much of a sledgehammer to be intrigue, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the only way I'm not going to come and attack while you're in Italy is if you give me these things. Have those things. It doesn't sound very intriguing, does it? It just sounds...
No. And he didn't try to negotiate, really, with any of the cities on the way through in a way that could be considered intrigue.
No.
No. I have to give him a zero. Like, he is the opposite of Ferdinand and Maximilian.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's Maximilian intriguing. I got the impression that he blundered through things. And either.
He attempted at least.
He just wasn't as lucky. He wasn't as lucky as Charles.
True.
I might give him a two just in case we've misread him completely. I don't think we have. But just in case.
I don't think we have either. But you want to give him a two?
I'm going to give him a two.
Can you give us at least one example?
I suppose I was about to say dealings with Florence, but no, that's completely opposite. He just No, I can't give you any. I'm going to give him zero as well.
Okay. I'm like, come on, do something here. Okay. So zero for Amphiboly.
Antiperistasis.
Rise and fall.
Now, if we talk about just the land he occupied for any length of time, that's massive.
Yeah, but think of the land he lost.
Well, yeah, he went up and then down.
Yeah, he gave away quite a lot of France initially.
Yes.
Then he took quite a lot of Italy. He took a lot of Italy.
Most of Italy. Yeah.
And then he sort of gave it back again. So I would say that is quite a roller coaster ride.
That is a huge roller coaster ride. Ultimately, he essentially made himself emperor, but then lost it.
Mm. Had he lived longer, he might have made himself emperor because he had bought the emperorship of Constantinople.
Yes.
He just hadn't had a chance to play that card yet.
Yeah. I'm going with a nine, only because he lost it.
Yeah.
It would have been a full 10 if he had kept as much of Italy as he had. He had more of Italy than the Holy Roman Emperor did.
Yeah, and he must have had more than it. I'm trying to work out. I'll have to look on the map to see if he actually gained more of Italy than he lost of France.
He did. He definitely did.
I'd have thought he must have done. I'm not sure how big Sedan and Roussillon
were. Not very big. If we here.
Yeah, I think I'll go with a. You're going with a nine. I think I'll go with a seven because I'm leaving the really high scores to people who come from nothing. You know, somebody like Cromwell or Wolsey or somebody like that. So I think I'll plump for seven. Plump.
So what he gave up is this and this tiny thing. Mm. He gained that.
Yeah.
A bunch in it here, Florence. Like, it's quadrupling the size of what he would have. Give it up.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's worth... You can see he thought it was worth the...
The risk, yeah. If you just look at the territories of France that he controlled, Naples is almost the same size.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just Naples. He took a bunch of things on the way.
Yes. I don't know how much Burgundy he handed over to Maximilian. But, yeah. I mean, that's... You're talking about half of Italy. You're talking about... Midway up the calf of Italy, aren't you?
So I'm sticking with my nine, yeah.
It does seem crazy what he did to start with. You just think, blimey, you are so obsessed with this.
That you're giving
up land.
You're
willing to give away chunks of land. But
you compare the two sizes and the incomes. Because those weren't wealthy provinces. The only thing they had going for them was a bit of Ruscio, I think it was, had stolen some merino sheep.
Oh, so they didn't need to import.
Import from Spain. But I don't know what happened to them because it doesn't stay there. I wonder if once Ferdinand got hold of him, he made them send him back to Castile. Nobody here is allowed to own merino sheep. Okay, so you're
and,
giving...
And Côte de Roussillon wine as well. Nice cheap red wine.
Cheap. So you're...
I'm going for a seven. Okay. Just because he hasn't come up from rags.
Right.
But he has definitely had quite a ride.
Yeah. So that's 16 for antiperistasis.
Martyrdom.
I don't see. I can't think of any reason to say he martyred himself.
He was willing to martyr Louis.
I don't think you're allowed to martyr other people and get marks for martyrdom.
Can you consider it martyrdom that he completely disregarded every single advisor and went ahead with the invasion of Italy? He put himself in a situation where he was cut off from escape and somehow managed to find a way back.
No, I think you put that under stupidity. Our own stupidity. We didn't think to put him around for that because it would have been quite useful. I wouldn't put that under martyrdom, I don't think.
I'm going to give him a one.
Okay.
You're giving him a zero?
I'm giving him a zero. I can't...
Okay.
I don't see him as a martyr.
That is a one for martyrdom.
B-team.
Well, we've already looked at how everything changed because of what he did.
It is huge.
Hmm. It's not a case that people know a lot about him, because I could only find, well, I say I could only find a book. I found three volumes of a book by John Bridge.
But he's not a well-known French king.
No, precisely. That's the only book I found in English about him. And that's not just about him. It's the kings from Louis the 11th. So he just happens to be the first one in the book.
Wow.
Although it's two volumes of him. So it was quite a godsend, really, because I was thinking, I can't find anything. And then I came across these books and thought, wow, yeah, this is a goldmine.
Yeah.
And I tell you what that book has, which I've just mentioned, just in case there's any publishers listening, is that it had the year on the top of the page.
Oh!
Every page had the year that we were looking at, which is great, because you don't have to keep going back and back and back, thinking, well, I can't remember which year we're in.
Yeah.
Yes, that was very handy. Anyone from any history publications are listening.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah, that was great. But no one's heard of him, but he made a huge change.
At the time?
Temporarily,
What kind of lasting change happened, though? Nothing, really. I mean, he didn't even keep the Aragonese out of Naples. They just came right back. They were invited back.
I mean, we're talking about... the whole thing took 15 months, but his time in Naples was minimal.
Yeah. One.
Because
everybody else, we've said it had to continue until now, or it had to last a long time. And his release, it didn't.
Yeah, and the league didn't last very long either. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go for three because it made a sudden burst of big impact and then whooshed away. But
okay, I'm going to stick with the one.
Yeah.
So that's four for Batim.
Flaunt a bleeding flaunt.
I emailed you some pictures.
Yes, here we go.
Charles, he seems to be something of a chameleon because none of his portraits look like any of his other portraits.
No, the nose seems the same all the way through. My God, he has a very big nose.
Well, I don't know, the youngest one, he's wearing that rather spectacular red hat with the black diamonds.
Oh, there we go. Oh, yeah, that's a nice hat.
Yeah, it's rather spectacular, yeah. And he's got quite a look on him as a sort of don't mess with me look. But
he does have a very strange shaped head, though. And by that, I mean he has a very, like his eyes are really high up on his head.
On the young one?
The young one and the third one you sent me.
Well, I think if we look at the young one first, because the young one is completely different to the others, isn't it? Because he looks like a normal, healthy, slightly spoilt.
Yes. With a decent nose. He doesn't have the gigantic nose.
Yeah. And then you get to the next one.
Gosh, I love the clothing detail.
And this I don't know where this nose came from. It's suddenly gone vroom, hasn't it?
Yes.
I notice he's wearing a collar of shells. I don't know if that's a sort of pilgrim.
Oh.
Editing Lucy here, I later discovered that the collar is of the Order of St. Michael. Get that in before people write in and tell me.
They look like gold.
Yeah. I mean, the next one down, he looks okay. He's got a massive nose.
Yeah, all of these three that you've given me, given the same nose. So he's got very dark hair, dark eyes, light skin. He's wearing the same sort of clothing all the way through, which makes sense because he didn't live long enough for fashion to change.
No, he didn't.
No chin.
And then we get to the last one, which really does look like that description
the frog,
of him that you said was a frog.
Bulging eyes.
He's got the protruding eyes.
And that's the one where I'm saying he has no top of his head. Almost like he has, what is that called? Phallocephaly? Is that what it's called?
I'm not sure. I wonder if that's what he looked like, or whether that's whether the artist accidentally painted his features too high up his face.
I don't know, but if that's this image, okay, so he's got his hands clasped in front of him. He's only wearing one ring, which is surprising. No collar of office.
He's looking very apologetic.
Yes, he's wearing a great deal of fancy fabrics. He's got the slashing in the sleeves to show the silk underneath, and very detailed cuffs, and just a plain black hat. Again, dark hair bobbed, gigantic nose. His chin...
That nose, it takes up the entire face, really,
yeah,
doesn't it?
The chin isn't as recessive as the one above it.
No, the one above is not an attractive look. Yeah, I mean, if we hadn't had that description of him before, or those descriptions, I would have said, oh, that's obviously a terrible artist.
Is it? Or is it just an artist that actually shows what he looks like and everybody else is trying to make him look better?
Yes, I was thinking, do you remember in Leonardo's episode, Isabella d'Este was very annoyed with the people who painted her because they made her look fat.
Yes.
And she got very cross about
it. Even though she was fat.
Even though she, yes. So.
The thing that I'm thinking of is this last picture, his head does look deformed, basically. Not enough on top.
Yeah.
And that one makes me think, yeah, a bump to the head could hurt him.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, this picture is what I was thinking of when I said maybe he does have a thin cranium or something.
Yeah. But not a good-looking guy. I don't see any symbolism.
No, apart from these shells, which I presume
are a badge.
Means he's been on a pilgrimage at some time.
Hmm. I do like that he has multiples of them, though.
Yes, and I like the fact that that last one fits the description.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting face.
Yes.
It's an odd face. I'm going to give him...
You'd definitely recognize him if you ran into him. You'd know that was Charles.
Yeah, I think it's a bit much of that artist to say, just looking at him gave him nightmares. It seems a bit much.
Yeah, which is why I think that third one is probably the most representative.
Well, I wonder if the third one was when he was going down Italy and it was all going swimmingly and they were having lots to eat and things. And this emaciated one at the bottom is coming back up again.
When he's got nothing.
When they had nothing.
Then I like it even more for the range that we have. We have him young and then going through life. Yeah, I'd like to give this a 9 just because of the differences between them and our ability to speculate on them.
Yeah, it's when there's nothing to talk about that you think, oh,
yeah.
I think I'll go with an 8 because we haven't got the symbolism.
Oh,
apart from
right.
The shells that we're not entirely sure about. But I do like that last one. It's just...
Yeah. Okay, I agree with you. I'm going to go with an 8 as well.
Okay.
So that's an 8 for Flauntiflaunt. Okay. So his total is 29.
Well, he did get most of that through antiperistasis, and a lot of that was the fact that he lost Naples.
Very true.
So,
final question.
Anyway, let's ask this question then.
Are they too delicious or what?
What do you think?
I'm sorry, no.
No. You amaze me.
The only way he could get it is if we had some sort of category for the amount of luck that he had.
Yes. I mean, he is about the luckiest person I've ever come across.
Yeah. And I got absolutely no real feel for him. He started off as totally wishy-washy and then stuck to his guns for a long time. Like, yeah. It was really hard to peel his personality out of that.
I mean, when it began to go wrong, how many people were muttering behind his back, I told you we should never have come.
All of them. Every single one.
So, yeah, he must have been, you know, striding on ahead, thinking, they all hate me.
Yeah.
They all hate me. No, I've got to agree. Sorry, Charles. But
sorry.
Lucky, lucky man. But not...
That's a no.
But I get another person out of the box. We haven't done this for ages.
Oh, yeah. Okie dokie.
Well, I would just say, before we look at the next one, that if more than 5 hours isn't enough for you for Charles VIII, our sister podcast, Battle Royale, has also just done Charles VIII, so you can compare and contrast. I haven't listened to it yet. I deliberately didn't listen. I thought I'm going to give myself that treat tomorrow. After I've committed myself to what I think about him. So I might listen to that and think, oh, yes, now they have a point.
Okay, you ready?
The nemesis of Bishop Fox. You got John Morton, Archbishop of Canterbury.
About time we had him. Right, okay.
Cool.
Okay. And I know all about Morton's fork. That wasn't Morton's
yes.
fork.
It was
Fox's fork.
It was fork.
Fox's
fork.
He stole his fork.
Oh. Ooh, that one's going to be good. That is the end of our episode on Charles VIII. We hope you've enjoyed it and will join us for the next episode on... Who is coming out next?
You, I think.
Yes, Margaret of Burgundy.
Margaret of Burgundy. And we should just mention that we did, because I don't think we, it wasn't mentioned at the end of the episode, that you said you would wanted to do one now,
yes.
and we pulled it a while ago.
Yes. It took.
And got Margaret of Burgundy, which is very exciting. I'm looking forward to this one. I'm looking forward to sitting back and drinking my tea when it's hot for a change. And hearing all about Auntie Margaret.
Yes, yes, I'm back.
Yeah, brilliant.
Thank you for listening.
You can find details of the podcast and contact us on
Tudor River, a Starboard Press.com. Email TudorRiverUs@gmail.com. We're on Podbean and all the usual platforms. Also Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
In the meantime, the very substance of the ambitious is merely the shadow of a dream.
I can see his pride peep through each part of him.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
They think I'm insane. That I've got war on the brain. That I'm tilting at windmills and it's all been in vain. They think I'm half-witted. They're quite discomfited. They think they can sway me, but I'm wholly committed. Louis just wants Milan. Ludovico the big man. Alexander just wants what is best for his kids. Venice just wants to trade the Swiss to invade. Maximilian wants money cause he's still on the skids. To get home.